product, those interests will almost invariably be readily identifiable based on objective factors. Because the president's conduct in those instances will obviously fall outside the zone of obstruction law, no chilling concern should arise. B. There is also no reason to believe that investigations, let alone prosecutions, would occur except in highly unusual circumstances when a credible factual basis exists to believe that obstruction occurred. Prosecutorial action enjoys a presumption of regularity. Absent clear evidence to the contrary, courts presume that prosecutors have properly discharged their official duties. Armstrong, 517 U.S. at 464. Quote in United States v. Chemical Foundation, Inc., 272 U.S. 1, 14-15, 1926. The presumption of prosecutorial regularity would provide even greater protection to the president than exists in routine cases, given the prominence and sensitivity of any matter involving the president and the likelihood that such matters will be subject to thorough and careful review at the most senior levels of the Department of Justice. Under OLC's opinion that a sitting president is entitled to immunity from indictment, only a successor administration would be able to prosecute a former president. But that consideration does not suggest that a president would have any basis for fearing abusive investigations or prosecutions after leaving office. There are obvious political checks against initiating a baseless investigation or prosecution of a former president. See Administrator of General Services, 433 U.S. at 448. Considering political checks and separation of powers analysis. And the Attorney General holds the power to conduct the criminal litigation of the United States government, United States v. Nixon, 418 U.S. at 694, citing 28 U.S.C. Section 516, which provides a strong institutional safeguard against politicized investigations or prosecutions. Footnote 1092. These considerations distinguish the Supreme Court's holding in Nixon v. Fitzgerald that, in part, because inquiries into the president's motives would be highly intrusive, the president is absolutely immune from private civil damages actions based on his official conduct. 457 U.S. at 756-757. As Fitzgerald recognized, there is a lesser public interest in actions for civil damages than, for example, in criminal prosecutions. Fitzgerald, 457 U.S. at 754-37. See Cheney, 542 U.S. at 384. And private actions are not subject to the institutional protections of an action under the supervision of the Attorney General and subject to a presumption of regularity. Armstrong, 517 U.S. at 464. C. In the rare cases in which a substantial and credible basis justifies conducting an investigation of the President, the process of examining his motivations to determine whether he acted for a corrupt purpose need not have a chilling effect. Ascertaining the president's motivations would turn on any explanation he provided to justify his actions, the advice he received, the circumstances surrounding the actions, and the regularity or irregularity of the process he employed to make decisions. But grand juries and courts would not have automatic access to confidential presidential communications on those matters. Rather, they could be presented in official proceedings only on a showing of sufficient need. Nixon, 418 U.S. at 712. In Re-Sealed Case, 121 F3D, 729, 754, 756-757, D.C. Circuit, 1997. See also Administrator of General Services, 433 U.S. at 448-449. Former President can invoke Presidential Communications Privilege, although successor's failure to support the claim detracts from its weight. In any event, probing the president's intent in a criminal matter is unquestionably constitutional in at least one context. The offense of bribery turns on the corrupt intent to receive a thing of value in return for being influenced in official action. 18 U.S.C. Section 201, B2. There can be no serious argument against the president's potential criminal liability for bribery offenses, notwithstanding the need to ascertain his purpose and intent. See U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 3, Article 2, Section 4. See also application of 28 U.S.C. Section 458 to presidential appointments of federal judges. 19. Opinion of Office of Legal Counsel at 357 N11. Application of Section 201 to the President raises no separation of powers issue, let alone a serious one. D. Finally, history provides no reason to believe that any asserted chilling effect justifies exempting the President from the obstruction laws. As a historical matter, presidents have very seldom been the subjects of grand jury investigations, and it is rarer still for circumstances to raise even the possibility of a corrupt personal motive for arguably obstructive action through the president's use of official power. Accordingly, the president's conduct of office should not be chilled based on hypothetical concerns about the possible application of a corrupt motive standard in this context. In sum, contrary to the position taken by the President's counsel, we concluded that, in light of the Supreme Court precedent governing separation of powers issues, we had a valid basis for investigating the conduct at issue in this report. In our view, the application of the obstruction statutes would not impermissibly burden the President's performance of his Article II function to supervise prosecutorial conduct or to remove inferior law enforcement officers. And the protection of the criminal justice system from corrupt acts by any person, including the president, accords with the fundamental principle of our government that no person in this country is so high that he is above the law. United States v. Lee, 106 U.S., 196, 220, 1882. See also Clinton v. Jones, 520 U.S., at 697. United States v. Nixon, Supra. 4. Conclusion. Because we determined not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment, we did not draw ultimate conclusions about the president's conduct. The evidence we obtained about the president's actions and intent presents difficult issues that would need to be resolved if we were making a traditional prosecutorial judgment. At the same time, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state, based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, we are unable to reach that judgment. Accordingly, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him.
Mueller and Trump, born to wealth, raised to lead, then sharply different choices.
By Mark Fisher and Sari Horwitz of The Washington Post.
They are the sons of wealth, brought up in families accustomed to power. They were raised to show and demand respect, and they were raised to lead. They rose to positions of enormous authority, the President of the United States and the special counsel chosen to investigate him. They dress more formally than most of those around them. Both sport meticulously coiffed hair. They've won unusual loyalty from those who believe in them. They attended elite all-male private schools, were accomplished high school athletes, and went on to Ivy League colleges. As young men, each was deeply affected by the death of a man he admired greatly. Yet Robert Swan Mueller III and Donald John Trump, born 22 months apart in New York City, can also seem to come from different planets. One is courtly and crisp, the other blustery and brash. One turned away from the path to greater wealth, while the other spent half a century exploring every possible avenue to add to his assets. At pivotal points in their lives, they made sharply divergent choices. As students, as draft-age men facing the dilemma of the Vietnam War, as ambitious alpha males deciding where to focus their energies. Now they face each other in a slow-moving, long-running confrontation that could end in anything from deeper political discord to a fatal blow to this presidency. For the 2+ years of the Russia investigation, Trump, 72, and Mueller, 74, have behaved much as they have throughout their lives. As the president fumed about a witch hunt and took his frustrations to his supporters, the special counsel remained publicly mute, speaking through inquiries, indictments, and finally, a report. The months flipped by and the showdown loomed. Mueller and Trump, the war hero and the draft avoider, two men who rise early and live mainly at the office, two men who find relief on the golf course. They circled each other, speaking different languages. One railed against the idea that there were facts to uncover. The other hewed to his career-long belief that the facts would out and the facts would resolve doubts. Their aides spoke in fits and starts about whether and when the two would meet, and in the end, they communicated only through written questions and answers, keeping to their missions, one loudly, the other in silence, neither knowing how this dramatic and divisive chapter of American history would end.
From Princeton to the Marines. Mueller was born to a social rank that barely exists anymore, a cosseted WASP elite of Northeastern families who sent their sons to New England prep schools built with generations of inherited wealth. Mueller's father was an executive at DuPont, part of a family firmly planted in the country's plutocracy. Mueller, who grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, and the Philadelphia Main Line, was sent to St. Paul's School in New Hampshire, where the Astor, Vanderbilt, and Mellon families educated their boys. At the Episcopal School, Mueller became captain of the soccer, ice hockey, and lacrosse teams. He played ice hockey with classmate John F. Kerry, a future Secretary of State, and one of three St. Paul's alumni who would run for president. Mueller epitomized the tradition of the muscular Christian at the top prep schools, the archetype of the strong boy who embodies values of kindness, respect, and integrity, said Maxwell King, 73, a classmate at St. Paul's. Bob was a very strong figure in our class. He was thought of as somebody you could count on to be thoughtful about everybody on the team and to have very high standards. King, a former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, who runs the Pittsburgh Foundation, said Mueller had a good sense of humor, but he wasn't smartass at all. He was serious, but in a way that everybody liked him and liked being around him. Mueller was, from early on, a role model. As a group of boys gathered one day at the Tuck, a snack shop at St. Paul's, a student made a derogatory comment about someone who wasn't there. Bob said he didn't want to hear that, King said. I mean, we all said disparaging things about each other face to face, but saying something about someone who wasn't there was something that Bob was uncomfortable with, and he let it be known and just walked out. At Princeton, which his father also had attended, Mueller was accepted into one of the most socially exclusive eating clubs, where he often was seen before dinner playing bridge by the sitting room fireplace. Mueller had planned to go to medical school, but as a classmate who studied with him recalled, organic chemistry got the better of him. Mueller pronounced himself defeated by the subject. He realized he would not be a doctor. Just a few weeks after he finished Princeton with a degree in politics in 1966, Mueller enlisted in the Marine Corps, a rare choice for an Ivy League graduate at a time when many young men were casting about for ways to avoid the draft. Mueller, who declined to be interviewed, has often said he was inspired to join the Marines by his lacrosse teammate David Hackett, who had graduated from Princeton a year earlier and gone off to fight in Vietnam. As we were graduating, we faced the decision of how to respond to the war in Vietnam, Mueller said in a speech in 2017. and a number of Hackett's friends and teammates joined the Marine Corps because of him, as did I. In April 1967, as he led his platoon in evacuating fallen Marines from a battleground, Hackett was shot in the back of the head by a North Vietnamese sniper. Mueller, to this day, speaks of Hackett's death as a turning point, as the event that pushed him to a career of public service. Before beginning his military training and while recovering from a knee injury, Mueller studied international relations at New York University. Then he started Officer Candidate School at Quantico, Virginia, where he excelled, although he did get a D in delegation. Mueller followed that, according to military records, by going through the Army's grueling Ranger School and Airborne School, unusual training for a Marine, signaling that he was going places. By November 1968, he was leading a rifle platoon in the jungles of Vietnam.
Off to military school. Like Mueller, Trump was raised in rare comfort. The Trumps had a family chef and chauffeur, but they never considered themselves part of the country's ruling class. Theirs was immigrant stock from Germany and Scotland, hardy entrepreneurs who tackled the new land with a blitz of new businesses, restaurants, hotels, and finally, real estate. The president's father, Fred Trump, made his fortune himself, building middle-class housing for the union workers and civil servants of New York's outer boroughs. Even after he'd established himself as one of the city's biggest builders, Fred Trump still toiled in the trenches, taking young Donald along on weekends when they went door to door at Trump Village in Brooklyn, collecting rent. Donald Trump grew up in a 23-room manse in Queens, a faux southern plantation house with a Cadillac limousine in the driveway. He attended private school from kindergarten on. His focus in school, Trump told the Washington Post in 2016, was creating mischief because, for some reason, I like to stir things up and I like to test people. It wasn't malicious so much as it was aggressive. In second grade, he said, he punched his music teacher in the face. He got into trouble often. Before eighth grade started, his father sent him to military school. At New York Military Academy, where the rules were so strictly enforced that a desperate cadet was said to have leaped into the Hudson River in an attempted escape, Trump thrived. Although he ate in a mess hall instead of being served steaks by the family cook, and although he slept in a barracks rather than his own room in a mansion, he for the first time took pride in his grades. He won medals for neatness and order. He also won notice from fellow cadets for touting his father's wealth and boasting to friends that I'm going to be famous one day. Trump competed to become a cadet leader and enjoyed wielding authority. As a junior supply sergeant in E Company, he ordered that a cadet be struck on the backside as punishment for breaking formation. Another time, while inspecting dorm rooms, Trump saw Cadet Ted Levine's unmade bed and blew up, ripping off the sheets and tossing them on the floor, Levine said. Levine threw a combat boot at Trump and hit him with a broomstick. Trump, infuriated, grabbed Levine and tried to push him out a second-story window, Levine said. Promoted to captain of A Company, Trump won respect from some of the other boys who said they never wanted to disappoint him. Trump introduced them to a world of fun, setting up a tanning salon in his dorm room, bringing beautiful women to campus and leading the baseball team to victory. But other cadets said Trump tried to break boys who didn't bend to his will. During Trump's senior year, when one of his sergeants shoved a new cadet against a wall for not standing at attention quickly enough, Trump was relieved of his duty in the barracks, said Lee Ains, the student who was shoved. Trump denied being demoted, saying he was actually moved up. You don't get elevated if you partake in hazing, he told the Washington Post in 2016. He was put in charge of a drill team that would perform in New York City's Columbus Day Parade.
Fleeting victories and fiery retreats. Mutter's Ridge was a killing ground, a craggy hellscape in Quantri Province, where the Marines had been fighting for years, setting up and abandoning bases as they tried over and over to assert control of one of the main routes the North Vietnamese used to infiltrate the South. Year after year, the ridge, hard by the demilitarized zone that separated North from South, was the scene of fierce assaults, fleeting victories, and fiery retreats. On December 11, 1968, Muller led a platoon of Marines into an 8-hour battle around an extensive complex of North Vietnamese army bunkers. The enemy hit Muller's men with a heavy volume of small arms, automatic weapons, and grenade launcher fire, according to a Marine Corps account. As his platoon suffered heavy casualties, Second Lieutenant Muller fearlessly moved from one position to another, directing the accurate counterfire of his men and shouting words of encouragement to them, the account said. Muller set up a defensive perimeter, and with complete disregard for his own safety, he then skillfully supervised the evacuation of casualties from the hazardous fire area, as the Marines put it. Muller led a team across the smoldering terrain and into a North Vietnamese-controlled area to recover a mortally wounded Marine. For that, he earned a Bronze Star Medal with V distinction for combat valor. He was promoted to First Lieutenant. 4 months later, the North Vietnamese attacked a squad of about a dozen Marines from Muller's platoon. Responding to the ambush, Muller led the rest of his men to assist the Marines under assault. They pushed ahead against heavy fire, and Muller was shot in the thigh. Although seriously wounded during the firefight, he resolutely maintained his position, and ably, directing the fire of his platoon, was instrumental in defeating the North Vietnamese Army Force, said the citation on the medal Muller received. His year in Vietnam was a turning point, Friend said. He never speaks to that horror and what he did, said Thomas B. Wilner, a longtime friend and Washington lawyer. A lifelong friend said that after Vietnam, Muller went from being this affable, good guy, good athlete, to having the backbone and the steel that he has today. But Muller doesn't talk about those harrowing months in the jungle. That is not his style. He doesn't brag about himself.
Draft deferments. The country felt as though it were coming apart at the seams. At the University of Pennsylvania, where Trump had transferred after 2 years at Fordham University in the Bronx, protests against the Vietnam War grew larger and more insistent. There were sit-ins, candlelight vigils, demonstrations against university contracts with the military, a metastasizing culture of conflict as a new generation pushed back against war, segregation, dress codes, and curfews. Trump took part in none of that, nor did he pay much attention to his coursework, fellow students said. He was already spending nearly as much time working for his father's real estate business in New York as he was on campus in Philadelphia. He said he spent many of his off hours while at school scouring the neighborhood for apartments to buy so he could rent them to students. Trump never burned a draft card, but he never enlisted either. He benefited from 5 draft deferments between 1964 and 1968, 4 for being a college student and 1 for a medical disqualification. Trump has said he had bone spurs in his foot. During his presidential campaign, Trump said he could not recall which foot had the spurs. Later, his campaign said he had them in both heels. At another point, a campaign statement said that in 1969, Trump was fit for service, and had his draft number been selected, he would have proudly served. His draft lottery number was 356 out of 366, high enough that he almost certainly would have been spared from mandatory service.
Muller, homicide. Muller spent the first 2 decades of his legal career putting bad guys behind bars. He worked as a prosecutor in San Francisco and Boston. And in Washington, he headed the Justice Department's criminal division as an assistant attorney general under President George H.W. Bush, supervising high-profile cases such as the prosecution of Panamanian dictator Manuel Antonio Noriega and the terrorist bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. But by 1995, he was ensconced in the $400,000-a-year luxury of a white-collar litigation job in the Washington office of a Boston law firm, Hale & Dorr. It was not a happy time. "He hated it," said Wilner, the longtime friend. "He couldn't stand selling his services to defend people he thought might be guilty." There was no hesitation for Bob in leaving a lucrative job to do what he thought was helping make the world a better place. So one day, Mueller called the district's local prosecutor, U.S. Attorney Eric H. Holder Jr., and asked for a job, not handling the office's big national cases, but working the line, prosecuting homicides on the streets of Washington. He wanted no title, no supervisory position. He told Holder that he was shaken by all of the killings in Washington, then the nation's murder capital, and that he just wanted to try homicide cases. "I was taken aback," Holder recalled. He reminded Mueller that coming to work at the Triple Nickel, as the prosecutor's office at 555 4th Street Northwest was called, would mean a pay cut of more than 75%, a big step down in stature, and a daunting job. The district, plagued with a crack cocaine epidemic and about 400 homicides a year, was a nightmare for prosecutors, who faced huge caseloads and witnesses who often were too scared to talk. Mueller said he knew what he was getting into. Holder hired him, but insisted on giving him a title, Senior Litigation Counsel, and eventually made him head of the homicide section. Day-to-day, though, Mueller was just a line guy, Holder said. He would be in those parts of Washington that were most affected by the violence. He would be interviewing people at crime scenes, going to people's homes to build cases, working with street cops. He got a kick out of answering his phone, "Mueller, homicide." "I love everything about investigations," Mueller said years later in an interview with UVA Lawyer, the magazine of the University of Virginia School of Law, where he earned his law degree. "I love the forensics. I love the fingerprints and the bullet casings and all the rest." He led the prosecution of high-profile cases, including the grisly murders in 1997 of three workers in a Starbucks coffee shop in Georgetown. D.C. police were not thrilled about the idea, but Mueller brought in a star FBI agent to work on the investigation. 3 years after the killings, a D.C. man was sentenced to life in prison without parole. "If it wasn't for Mueller, that case would never have been solved," said former longtime homicide detective James Tranum, who worked with Mueller on the case. With his quiet demeanor, he just kind of waded in and diplomatically parted the waters. Through the decades, Mueller has often said that what matters even more than the content of one's work is how we do it, as he put it in a commencement address in 2013. "You are only as good as your word. You can be smart, aggressive, articulate, and indeed persuasive. But if you are not honest, your reputation will suffer. And once lost, a good reputation can never be regained."
Tough enough to make it. Trump was determined to push beyond his father's realm in New York's outer boroughs and make it big in Manhattan. He had neither time nor patience for climbing the ladder rung by rung. He believed in big, bold leaps, even if that meant breaking with tradition or rules. "The key to the way I promote is bravado," he wrote in Trump, The Art of the Deal, his best-selling book. "I play to people's fantasies. People may not always think big themselves, but they can still get very excited by those who do. That's why a little hyperbole never hurts." It was Trump's older brother, Fred Jr., who was originally supposed to take over the family business. But Freddie, mild-mannered and, in Donald's view, not tough enough to make it, struggled to live up to his father's demands. Freddie left the family company to become an airline pilot, but he began drinking excessively. In 1981, at age 43, he died of a heart attack following years of alcoholism. Donald had adored his brother, and now he resolved never to drink alcohol and always to remember a lesson he drew from Freddie's failure: to keep my guard up 100%. Life is a series of battles ending in victory or defeat, he said at the time. You just can't let people make a sucker out of you. In contrast to his brother, Donald Trump was determined to do whatever it took to be a killer, as his father had repeatedly insisted. While working on his first hotel project in 1976, Trump persuaded a New York Times reporter to profile him as a major New York builder, even though he had never built a thing and had no financing. He touted his ties to power. In the mid-1970s, seeking to buy New York's World Trade Center, Trump had lunch with Peter C. Goldmark Jr., the head of New York's Port Authority, which owned the Twin Towers. You wouldn't last in your job very long if Governor Hugh Carey decided you weren't doing the right thing, Trump said, according to Goldmark. You should know I have a lot of weight in Albany. Goldmark said he ended the discussion after that. Trump denied Goldmark's account, saying, I really don't talk that way. Trump's knack for drawing attention sometimes embarrassed or persuaded the powers that were to cede to his demands. When city politicians who opposed granting Trump a tax incentive called a news conference outside the shuttered Commodore Hotel, Trump showed up and threatened to abandon the project if the city didn't give him tax relief. Trump had prepared for the event by directing his workers to replace the clean boards that covered the once grand building's windows with dirty scrap wood, accentuating the decrepit state of the Midtown eyesore. The dramatic flourish had the desired effect. Trump got the exemption. He beat the system.
G-Man. After Mueller did a stint as U.S. Attorney in San Francisco, President George W. Bush nominated him to direct the FBI. He was sworn in on September 4, 2001, 1 week before the planes hit the Twin Towers. For the next 12 years, in both Republican and Democratic administrations, Mueller led the FBI through one of the most difficult periods in its history. The Bureau shifted from a domestic law enforcement agency largely focused on criminal threats to a global intelligence organization reoriented to fight terrorism. Although more terrorist attacks were feared, Mueller was intent on protecting civil liberties, according to those who worked with him. He didn't allow FBI agents in the post-9/11 era to engage in interrogation techniques that he thought were inconsistent with American law and tradition, said Holder, who, as President Barack Obama's attorney general, was his boss once again. Mueller worked around the clock, traveling from his Georgetown home to FBI headquarters in a black SUV that arrived shortly after 6 a.m. for morning security briefings, heading back late at night. He wore a traditional J. Edgar Hoover-era G-Man uniform, dark suit, red or blue tie, and white shirt, always white. He won't wear a blue shirt, Wilner said. He is so straight, he always wears a white shirt. He's a pain in the ass in many ways because he's so straight. He's conscious that he's a public figure, and he doesn't want anything to compromise his integrity, even a blue shirt. Around the building, some privately dubbed him Bobby Three Sticks, a reference to both the Roman numeral at the end of his name and the three-finger Boy Scout salute. No one dared use the nickname in his presence, former Justice Department officials said. Mueller usually avoided the limelight. He frustrated his speechwriters by crossing out every I in speeches they wrote for him. It wasn't about him, he told them. It's about the organization.
Family and politics. Mueller burrowed into the bureaucracy and won allies by eschewing publicity. Trump charged into one industry after another, from casino gambling to stakes to for-profit education and finally to politics. The only through line in his career was his own celebrity, the power and allure of his name. In nearly every possible way, from their family relations to their political involvement, the two men have presented themselves in opposite ways. 3 months after he graduated from college, Mueller married his girlfriend, Anne Standish, whose ancestors had come to the United States on the Mayflower. The couple, who met at a party when they were 17, have two daughters. One of them has spina bifida, and at one point, Mueller took a job in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, in part to be near the treatment she needed. Throughout the investigation and earlier stages of his career, Mueller asked reporters not to discuss his family life. Trump, for decades, regularly sought coverage of his love life by gossip columnists and talked about his dates and bedroom activities with radio host Howard Stern. Trump has five children by three wives, each of them newcomers to New York City, two from Central Europe and one from a small town in Georgia. None was born to privilege. Like his father before him, Trump was distant from his children when they were very young, but grew close once they were mature enough to learn the family business and join him on his daily rounds. Mueller is a lifelong Republican who has worked for administrations of both parties. Trump was raised in a Republican home by a father who spent many weekends visiting the Democratic clubs of Brooklyn, building relationships with the politicians who might help him get his projects built. For four decades, Trump toyed with the idea of entering politics. He changed his party registration seven times between 1999 and 2012. He was a Democrat twice, a Republican three times, and an independent. In 2000, he briefly ran for president under the Reform Party banner. Once, when asked in a television interview why he was a Republican, he said, "I have no idea."
A friendly conversation. In the Rose Garden on June 21, 2013, Obama announced that James B. Comey would replace Mueller as FBI director. Like the Marine that he's always been, Bob never took his eyes off his mission, Obama said. It's a tribute to Bob's trademark humility that most Americans probably wouldn't recognize him on the street, but all of us are better because of his service. 4 years later, in May of 2017, the new president invited Mueller back to the White House. President Trump had abruptly fired Comey, and now, at the suggestion of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Mueller was coming in to talk about his former job. On his way into the Oval Office, Mueller met then-chief strategist Stephen K. Bannon, a former Navy officer, and teased him for letting his daughter go to West Point. Mueller and Trump spoke for about 30 minutes, according to a person familiar with the interview. It was a friendly conversation, but seemed almost pro forma because Mueller made it clear from the start that he was unlikely to take the job he had held for 12 years. Trump liked Mueller, according to the person. He thought he was smart and tough, a type Trump admires more than almost any other. The question became moot within days, as Deputy Attorney General Rod J. Rosenstein appointed Mueller as the special counsel to investigate whether the Trump campaign coordinated with Russian officials during the 2016 campaign. Trump heard the news and asked one of his aides, "Wasn't that guy just in here interviewing for the FBI?" This is an updated version of an article that appeared in the Washington Post on February 23, 2018.
The key documents in the special counsel's investigation, arranged in chronological order with introductions by the Washington Post. Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller III ran one of the highest-profile investigations in U.S. history and said almost nothing about it to the media. Throughout his work, Mueller never gave a public press conference, and his spokesman offered a simple no comment to almost every story with which he was presented. Instead, Mueller and his team spoke in court documents, laying out in detailed indictments and other filings what they had found and who they believed had committed crimes. Legal experts said Mueller's speaking indictments appeared designed not just to make criminal cases against individual defendants, but to educate the country about the evidence his team had gathered. Following is a limited selection of some of the most important documents of the Mueller investigation, which lay bare how the special counsel penetrated the inner workings of Russian hacking and social media influence operations and charged a host of Trump allies with a variety of wrongdoing. 1. Appointment Order. Acting Attorney General Rod J. Rosenstein, May 17, 2017. Robert S. Mueller III became special counsel on May 17, 2017, when Deputy Attorney General Rod J. Rosenstein affixed his signature to this single page of open-ended instructions. The document's brevity belies its significance. Rosenstein had just set in motion one of the most important investigations in U.S. history, one that would explore whether the president's campaign had worked with a foreign power to get him elected, and whether the president had then worked to thwart law enforcement's effort to figure out what happened. Rosenstein's order gave Mueller wide latitude. The Vietnam veteran and former FBI director was assigned to take over the inquiry into possible coordination between the Russian government and the Trump campaign, as well as any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation. That appeared to be a reference to an investigation, already opened at the time of Mueller's appointment, though not yet publicly confirmed, into whether President Trump had sought to obstruct justice. Rosenstein would issue a more detailed memo a few months later, providing a more specific description of Mueller's authority, and noting that his first order was worded categorically in order to permit its public release without confirming specific investigations involving specific individuals. 2. Statement of the Offense, U.S. versus George Papadopoulos, U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, October 5, 2017. Few people had ever heard of George Papadopoulos, a former campaign advisor to Donald Trump, when the special counsel's office announced on October 30, 2017, that he had pleaded guilty 3 weeks earlier to lying to the FBI. Papadopoulos's plea was an early indication of just how much Robert S. Mueller III was doing and learning in total secrecy. After all, Papadopoulos had been arrested at Washington Dulles International Airport in July and walked unnoticed into court to enter his guilty plea in early October, with not a word leaking to the public. This document outlines the nature of Papadopoulos's lies to the FBI, who first knocked on the energy consultant's Chicago door in January 2017 to ask him about Russia. Prosecutors revealed key information about the Trump team's flirtation with Russia during the campaign. Papadopoulos acknowledged that he worked to downplay his Russia contacts to the FBI to protect Donald Trump. In fact, soon after he was named a volunteer advisor to the campaign in March 2016, Papadopoulos had been befriended by an overseas professor, who informed him that the Russians held dirt on Democrat Hillary Clinton in the form of thousands of emails. The professor, who has been identified as Maltese academic Joseph Mifsud, introduced Papadopoulos to a female Russian national, who falsely told the young aide she was Vladimir Putin's niece, and a man described as a Russian national connected to the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Papadopoulos communicated extensively with the woman and the Russian man, think tank director Ivan Timofeev, working with the two and with Mifsud to try to organize a meeting between Trump campaign staff and Russians, perhaps even a face-to-face Trump-Putin encounter. Timofeev has said his think tank's interactions with Papadopoulos were routine academic outreach. Mifsud has confirmed that he is the professor referenced in the document, but denied wrongdoing or any knowledge that Russia held Clinton emails. The document also explained to the public that these Russian interactions were hardly a secret to Trump's most senior aides. Among those Papadopoulos told of his efforts were his campaign supervisor, later identified as Trump campaign co-chair Sam Clovis, as well as campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, referred to as a high-ranking campaign official, and campaign chairman Paul Manafort, another high-ranking campaign official. According to the document, Papadopoulos even informed Trump, announcing to the candidate at a March 31, 2016 meeting in Washington, D.C., that he could help arrange a meeting for him with Putin. 3. Statement of the offense. U.S. versus Michael T. Flynn, U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, December 1, 2017. On December 28, 2016, as his 8 years in office came to a close, President Obama imposed new sanctions on Russia as punishment for its interference in the 2016 presidential election. Uncharacteristically, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that he would take no immediate retaliation. President-elect Donald Trump tweeted that Putin's move was very smart. Putin's restraints sparked confusion in Washington, until the Washington Post reported that Trump's designated national security advisor, Michael T. Flynn, spoke several times with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak on the day the new sanctions were announced. At first, Flynn insisted that the two had exchanged pleasantries and had not discussed the sanctions. Flynn offered that story to the public, privately to Vice President Pence, and 4 days after Trump was inaugurated, to FBI agents sent to the White House to interview him about his Kislyak interactions. Flynn's statements were false. After the Post reported that Flynn had in fact talked sanctions with Kislyak, he resigned his White House job on February 14, 2017, after just 24 days in office. And 10 months later, on December 1st, he pleaded guilty to misleading the FBI and agreed to cooperate with Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller III. This 6-page statement of offense outlines exactly how Flynn lied. He agreed that he had asked Kislyak not to escalate the situation with the United States and had been told by Kislyak the next day that Putin's restraint was a direct response to Flynn's request. When Flynn resigned, Trump had said he had no idea that Flynn had talked to Kislyak about sanctions. But this document revealed that Flynn, who was traveling in the Dominican Republic at the time, had called a senior official of the presidential transition team, later identified as Flynn's deputy K.T. McFarland, before speaking with Kislyak to strategize what Flynn should say about sanctions. McFarland was spending the holidays with other senior officials and Trump at the president-elect's Florida club. Flynn also agreed that he lied to the FBI about another contact with Kislyak, a December 2016 phone call in which Flynn asked if Russia would delay or vote against a proposed United Nations resolution critical of Israel. Flynn said he made this call at the direction of a very senior member of the presidential transition team, identified later as Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Flynn also agreed that he had submitted false information to the Department of Justice as he belatedly registered as a foreign lobbyist for work he conducted during the campaign to benefit the Turkish government. Flynn was the highest-ranking Trump official to plead guilty and agree to assist Mueller, whose prosecutors praised Flynn's cooperation as he sat for 19 interviews over the following year. But at a stunning hearing in December 2018, U.S. District Court Judge Emmett G. Sullivan reminded the country of Flynn's fall as he conducted secret work for a foreign government and lied to federal agents on the grounds of the White House. "Arguably," Sullivan told Flynn, "you sold your country out." 4. Indictment in U.S. versus Internet Research Agency et al. U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, February 16, 2018. Robert S. Mueller III's first major strike against the Russians accused of election interference came in February 2018, when he filed this 37-page indictment detailing how the Internet Research Agency, a small company based in St. Petersburg, Russia, had engineered a massive online propaganda effort to push voters toward Donald Trump and away from his rival, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. The social media plot was hatched in 2014, before most Americans had begun to think about the presidential election. According to the indictment, by the spring of 2016, these Russians had decided they would support Trump and work to damage Clinton. The indictment was remarkable in its specificity, revealing that investigators had access to the group's internal communications, including an email from September 2017 in which one charged employee of the company wrote to a family member. The FBI busted our work, not a joke. The special counsel also alleged that these Russians worked offline as well, asserting that three of those charged visited 10 states to gather intelligence about U.S. politics. The group had online conversations with Americans, who became unwitting pawns, the special counsel alleged. The Russians persuaded Americans to hold rallies in support of Trump and paid for costumes and other materials so rallies could feature Americans dressed as Clinton in a prison jumpsuit. At this stage, the special counsel notably did not accuse the Russian government of wrongdoing, nor did the indictment detail any Russian hacking. That would come later in a similarly detailed indictment, in which Mueller took aim at the Russian military intelligence unit believed to have hacked the emails of Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, and the Democratic National Committee. One of the named defendants in the case, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who prosecutors alleged helped fund the effort, told a Russian state news agency that he was not upset to be charged. A company connected to Prigozhin that was also named in the indictment has denied the charges and hired U.S. lawyers to fight the case in court. 5. Indictment in U.S. versus Viktor Borisovich Netekshow et al. U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, July 13, 2018. At the core of the Russia investigation was always the 2016 hacking and publishing of emails from the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. In January 2017, U.S. officials attributed the attack to Russia and said the operation was personally directed by President Vladimir Putin. It was left to Robert S. Mueller III to sort out the specifics and determine if any Americans shared blame. A little more than a year into his investigation, Mueller made this much clear. He knew exactly who carried out the hack and how they did it. In this 29-page indictment of a dozen officers of the Russian military intelligence, known as the GRU, Mueller described in granular detail how the group hacked the emails, then laundered the stolen messages through fake online personas so they could be shared to influence voters. Notably, Mueller did not include any Americans in the indictment, and he similarly spared the anti-secrecy organization WikiLeaks, which is identified in the document only as Organization 1. Mueller did, however, describe an online conversation between the GRU, posing as a person called Guccifer 2.0, and a person who was in regular contact with senior members of the presidential campaign of Donald J. Trump. Roger Stone has acknowledged that description refers to him. Mueller also revealed a detail that, even if it was mere coincidence, seemed remarkable. On July 27, 2016, Trump gave a press conference declaring his hope that missing Hillary Clinton emails would be found and made public, saying, "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing." Russia seemed to spring into action. According to Mueller's indictment, on or about that same day, those involved in the hacking tried to spearfish for the first time email accounts at a domain hosted by a third-party provider and used by Clinton's personal office. The indictment alleged, at or around the same time, they also targeted 76 email addresses at the domain for the Clinton campaign. The Russian officers named in the indictment have not responded to the allegations. 6. Statement of the Offenses and Other Acts. U.S. versus Paul J. Manafort, Jr. U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, September 14, 2018. Paul Manafort's legal travails formed the longest-running legal saga in the special counsel investigation. He was charged in federal court in Washington, D.C. on October 30, 2017, with crimes related to his work as a political consultant in Ukraine, then charged again in February 2018 in Virginia, where he lived, with additional allegations, including that he filed fraudulent loan applications to banks. Accused of trying to reach out to witnesses to coach them on his defense, he was tossed in jail in June 2018, then tried in Virginia and convicted on 8 felony counts. Finally, averting a second trial, he pleaded guilty in September 2018 to charges brought in Washington. This 24-page statement of offenses describes all of Paul Manafort's crimes. He agreed that he conspired against the United States by illegally laundering through offshore accounts the $60 million he earned working in Ukraine from 2006 to 2016. He evaded $15 million in U.S. taxes by failing to properly inform the IRS of those accounts and by lying to his own accountants and tax preparers. He failed to register as a foreign lobbyist while helping his Ukrainian clients press their views in Washington and, when questioned, submitted false information to the Department of Justice about his work. Manafort had helped Viktor Yanukovych get elected president of Ukraine in 2010. But after Yanukovych rejected a plan to move his country toward membership in the European Union, he was ousted from office by public protests and fled to Russia. Manafort's Ukrainian gravy train dried up. Unable to continue supporting his lavish lifestyle, Manafort conceded that he committed bank fraud by lying on loan applications. After he was charged by Robert S. Mueller III, Manafort attempted to try to tamper with witnesses in partnership with a longtime Russian associate, Konstantin Kalimnik. Kalimnik, who lives in Moscow, has ties to Russian intelligence, according to Mueller. Kalimnik was also charged in the effort to tamper with witnesses. He's in Russia and has not publicly addressed the obstruction charge, though court documents show that Manafort told prosecutors that Kalimnik didn't think he had suborned perjury and thought it was crazy that he was indicted. The conduct outlined by Mueller painted a devastating portrait of Donald Trump's campaign chairman. Manafort had volunteered to work for Trump for free, but was drowning in debt at the time. He appeared eager to use his campaign role to angle for money from his wealthy patrons in Ukraine and Russia, working in concert with an alleged Russian intelligence asset. His service for Trump coincided with the ramp-up of Russians' intervention in the U.S. election and a ratcheting up of Trump's pro-Russia campaign rhetoric. For all those reasons, Manafort's decision to plead guilty and cooperate with Mueller was seen as a potential turning point for the special counsel. But in December 2018, Mueller announced yet one more twist. His team said Manafort, after sitting for 12 interviews and 2 sessions with the grand jury, had breached his plea agreement. They said he was still lying about matters important to the investigation. 7. Criminal Information, U.S. versus Michael Cohen, U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, November 29, 2018. Of all Trump's allies to cooperate with the special counsel's investigation, perhaps the most interesting was Michael Cohen, the president's personal lawyer. Fierce loyalty to Trump was long what defined Cohen, who considered himself more fixer and protector than legal advisor. But as investigators dove into Cohen's personal finances, finding criminal tax and bank fraud that could subject him to significant prison time, Trump's fixer turned into another problem for the president. Cohen ultimately pleaded guilty in multiple cases, one in which he agreed to facilitating hush money payments to help the president cover up alleged affairs, and another in which he admitted lying to Congress about a possible Trump business project in Moscow. He began cooperating with the special counsel's team. Cohen's lie to Congress, detailed in this criminal information, was remarkable. It showed he had been willing to deceive the public and then commit a crime to keep secret the timing of his dealings with the Kremlin. Cohen admitted that he had told Congress work on the Moscow project ended in January 2016. In fact, it lasted until June 2016, after Trump had sealed up the Republican nomination for president. Cohen also conceded he had direct contact with a Kremlin official to request help with the project, speaking by phone to an assistant to Dmitry Peskov, a powerful Putin aide. The document indicates the assistant took notes and promised she would follow up with others in Russia. Peskov has said Russian officials gave it routine business consideration. The document described Trump as Individual One and the Trump Organization as a Manhattan-based real estate company. The special counsel's office would reveal in a later court filing that Cohen met with its investigators 7 times and provided information on core topics under investigation that was deemed credible and consistent with other evidence. Prosecutors wrote that they believed the motive for his lying to Congress was to minimize links between the Moscow Project and Trump. That was worrisome for Trump. Cohen, one of Trump's closest confidants, was talking frequently to the office investigating Trump. And while he might have been able to attack Cohen's credibility, Cohen, after all, was an admitted liar, the special counsel's office had cryptically hinted they had evidence to back up what the president's fixer was saying. 8. Transcript of sentencing hearing. U.S. versus Michael Cohen. U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, December 12, 2018. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, had admitted arranging secret payoffs to women to keep quiet about alleged affairs with Trump and to lying about a Trump business project in Moscow that was pursued during the heart of Trump's campaign. On a cold, windy day in December 2018, he stood before a federal judge in Manhattan to hear what punishment he would receive for those crimes. The sentencing hearing, which is captured word for word in this transcript, was remarkable. Cohen, in a charcoal suit and light blue tie, sniffed and fought back tears as he pleaded for leniency from Judge William H. Pauley III. Cohen said he had felt duty-bound to cover up Trump's dirty deeds, and in some ways, his life was beginning anew now that he was free from the personal and mental incarceration that came from working for Trump. A prosecutor from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan blasted Cohen for his personal wrongdoing. A special counsel's office lawyer was gentler, noting that Cohen had been helpful to the special counsel's probe. Pauley sentenced Cohen to 3 years behind bars, along with nearly $2 million in financial penalties, crediting Cohen for his cooperation but rejecting Cohen's bid to avoid prison entirely. While Mr. Cohen has taken steps to mitigate his criminal conduct by pleading guilty and volunteering useful information to prosecutors, that does not wipe the slate clean, Pauley said. 9. Indictment in U.S. versus Roger Jason Stone, Jr., U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, January 24, 2019. Perhaps the most colorful character in the special counsel investigation was Roger Stone, a longtime Republican political operative and Donald Trump friend who sports a tattoo of Richard Nixon on his back. Stone, who publicly cheered on WikiLeaks as the organization released hacked Democrats' emails during the presidential campaign, had said for months he would be charged by Robert S. Mueller III. On January 24, 2019, his prediction came true. And early the next day, a team of FBI agents, armed and wearing bulletproof vests, knocked on the door of Stone's Florida home and took him into custody. The special counsel had secured this 7-count indictment against the 66-year-old political operative, alleging that Stone had tried to thwart congressional inquiries into Russian interference in the election. He was charged with lying to Congress, obstruction, and witness tampering. Stone vowed to plead not guilty and fight the charges. The indictment alleged that Stone attempted to keep lawmakers from uncovering his efforts to get information about WikiLeaks' release of the hacked emails after it was publicly alleged the hacking was done by the Russian government. It noted pointedly that a senior Trump campaign official was directed to contact Stone about WikiLeaks' releases and possible damaging information the group had about Hillary Clinton's campaign, Prosecutors identified WikiLeaks only as Organization One. It was unclear who the senior campaign official is. Stone thereafter told the Trump campaign about potential future releases of damaging material by Organization One, the indictment alleged. The indictment detailed in particular Stone's communication with Steve Bannon, who was then Trump's chief strategist and is identified in the indictment as a high-ranking Trump campaign official, as well as two of Stone's associates, Jerome Corsi, a conservative writer identified in the indictment as Person One, and Randy Credico, a New York comedian and radio host identified in the indictment as Person Two. By prosecutors' telling, Stone had tried through Credico and Corsi to get information from WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange, though he would later tell lawmakers falsely he had no records about that. Corsi's lawyers confirmed he is Person One in the indictment, but noted it does not accuse Dr. Corsi of any wrongdoing, and indeed, this is the case. Lawyers for Bannon and Credico declined to comment. All three were identified by people familiar with the case, and communications described in the indictment match their publicly known communications. While the indictment did not charge Stone with conspiring with Russia, the allegations suggest that the campaign was willing to seek out and use messages hacked by a foreign state as political ammunition. And it provided lively anecdotes about how Stone sought to stymie investigators' work. For example, it alleged that in November 2017, Stone told Credico to stonewall after the House Intelligence Committee sought his testimony. The next month, he invoked a character from the mafia movie The Godfather Part II, who, during a congressional hearing, told lawmakers, "I don't know nothing about that." "And if you turned over anything to the FBI, you're a fool," Stone told Credico, according to the indictment. 10. Letter from Attorney General William P. Barr to U.S. Senate and House Judiciary Committees, March 24, 2019. On Friday, March 22, 2019, just before a sudden hailstorm descended upon Washington, D.C., a security officer from Robert S. Mueller III's office arrived at the Justice Department to deliver the final report from the special counsel. The investigation was over. Attorney General William P. Barr broke the news in a mere one-page letter to lawmakers, in which he said he would work on giving them Mueller's principal conclusions before the weekend was out. About 48 hours later, he made good on his promise, giving them this four-page summary of the special counsel's top-line findings. The letter was a political windfall for President Trump. "No one else would be indicted," Barr wrote, "and Mueller did not find that Trump or anyone associated with his campaign had conspired with Russia to interfere in the election." That offered the president strong support for his constant refrain of no collusion. Further, Barr wrote, Mueller had declined to make a prosecutorial judgment on the question of whether Trump obstructed justice, but instead had described the facts he had found and noted, "While this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him." Barr wrote that he and Deputy Attorney General Rod J. Rosenstein reviewed the question themselves and determined the evidence was not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense. Trump seized on the letter to declare he had been vindicated, and he and his allies turned their fire on those who had launched the investigation in the first place and the journalists and commentators who had covered it aggressively. Democrats, meanwhile, attacked Barr for offering an opinion they felt no one had asked for, and pressed the Attorney General to release Mueller's entire report, which they hoped might offer unflattering information for the president. Polling had shown that people's views of Mueller's investigation split sharply on partisan lines, and the reaction to Barr's letter confirmed that his findings would be assessed through political lenses. The Attorney General's summary shifted the battle from the law enforcement arena to Congress, with no sign that the country's sharp divide over Trump was likely to abate anytime soon.
The Mueller Report, with related materials by The Washington Post. Introduction and analysis written and read by reporters Rosalind S. Helderman and Matt Zapatosky, with reporters Sari Horwitz and Mark Fisher. Read by Prentice Oniemi, Dennis Boutsikaris, Cassandra Campbell, Gibson Frazier, Robin Miles, Fred Sanders, Jamie Mettler, Vikas Adam, Joy Osmansky, Cynthia Farrell, and Samantha Dez. Editing by Chris Benelli, Robert Carpenter, Matt Kartsonis, Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director, Scott Cresswell, Mike Ticino, Thomas Figueroa, Terry Hogan, Finn Eichner, Nikki Banks Marrer, John Marshall Media, Ryan Lissy Audio, Kessler Media Productions, Ryan Schindler, John St. Dennis, and Stephen Strassman. Post-production, mix, and mastering by Terry Hogan. Produced by Taryn Agobiato, Anna Chan, Tiffany Ferrari, Aaron Larson, Allison Light, Michael Noble, Elisa Shokoff, Louisa Solomon, and Christina Zarafanidis. Special thanks to Daniel Mish and Brooke Lawrence at the Washington Post Audio Facility and Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Dedicated to Mildred Ludwig Solomon. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio and The Washington Post. The Mueller Report is available in print from Scribner.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.